Welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for December the 26th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Pharmacy's Key in Shot Rollout. CVS, Walgreens get vaccine contracts for long-term care centers. In the coming weeks, the earliest rounds of vaccinations for COVID-19 are aimed at two groups, healthcare workers broadly and those who live and work in long-term care facilities. The former slate of vaccinations is often being covered from within. At Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center, vaccinations of frontline workers on Tuesday were handled in part by colleagues. According to Mercy One North Iowa President and CEO Ron Schlader, the hospital's aim was to have 300 to 400 staff members vaccinated by the end of the day. When it comes to long-term facilities and the people who live and work there, vaccination responsibilities for COVID are going to be more delegated. According to Kara Koster, a spokesperson for ABCM, which oversees both Heritage Care and Rehabilitation in Mason City and the Oakwood Care Center in Clear Lake, vaccinations at 31 ABCM facilities in Iowa will come through a pharmacy partnership for a long-term care program. Very early in the process, we partnered with CVS Omnicare to get everything set up, so once those dates are determined, we'll begin, Koster said. The intent is for those vaccinations to start happening next week, but Koster made it clear that such dates aren't solid yet and things can still fluctuate. We've been told things from the government, and then it changes the next week, Koster said. While ABCM is working through the CVS group to vaccinate its employees and residents, Good Shepherd, which operates 7 separate facilities in Mason City, is going a different route. According to Good Shepherd CEO Ian Stockberger, Walgreens will be assisting with vaccination efforts. Walgreens spokesperson Emily Delnicki said that the company wasn't able to provide specifics on all the times and locations for vaccinations in Iowa yet, but did say that Walgreens pharmacy team members will provide COVID-19 vaccinations in approximately 800 long-term care facilities across 12 states, 13 jurisdictions, the week of December 21st. Delnicki then went on to say in an email that the company will begin clinics in an additional 39 states the week of December 28th, or once a jurisdiction is approved to begin by the Centers for Disease Control. We will continue to expand vaccinations to nearly 3 million residents and staff at 35,000 long-term care facilities that have selected Walgreens as their vaccine provider as states finalize their distribution plans and receive vaccine allocations, Delnicki said in an email. For CVS, the intent is to begin on December 28th in 486 nursing and assisted living facilities in Iowa, which totals nearly 50,000 people by their estimate. According to CVS Corporate Communications Manager Courtney Tavner, the mix of healthcare professionals who will assist in the vaccinations include pharmacists, nurses, and licensed pharmacy technicians. This expertise, along with our national scale and local presence, which we have used, to administer flu vaccinations and to mobilize COVID-19 testing solutions in communities across the country, will be applied to this national effort to safely and effectively distribute COVID-19 vaccines, she wrote in an email. Tavner then went on to say that at some point in 2021, CVS hopes to provide vaccines to the general public in its pharmacy locations across the United States. At present, there are current outbreaks at 127 long-term care facilities across Iowa. In North Iowa area of December 23rd, there are 2 outbreaks listed in Butler County at Maple Manor Village and Valley View Community, 3 outbreaks in Cerro Gordo across Good Shepherd System at Oakwood and Rockwell Community Nursing Home, 1 in Floyd, the Chattatooga Guest Home No. 2, 2 in Kossuth, Algonia Manor Care Center and Good Samaritan Society Algonia, 2 in Mitchell, Good Samaritan Society St. Ansgar, and Osage Rehab and Healthcare Center, and 3 in Wright County, Clarion Wellness and Rehabilitation Center, Rehabilitation Center of Belmont, and Rotary Senior Living. Over the 9 months that the pandemic has impacted the state, there have been 5,195 positive tests for COVID-19, and 1,137 people in long-term care facilities have died with the virus. Now on to a similar article, Pandemic Takes Toll on ICU Workers. When the COVID-19 pandemic eventually subsides, Emily Orton, a critical care director for Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City, just wants to browse the placid aisles of Target with a warm Starbucks drink in hand again. Orton, a healthcare worker with more than a decade of experience, doesn't want to have to keep thinking about whether or not it's safe to bring her kids with her when she goes out. She wants her preschool-age son to know a world that's about more than masks and social distancing. She wants her fellow staff members coming off of long shifts and uncomfortable safety equipment to know how meaningful the work they're doing is right now, even as some people in the community downplay the virus. We've had great teamwork, but that's really hard. How do I express all of the gratitude that they deserve? She asks. That exhausted feeling is something workers across the region have felt. And that question is something that so many of their bosses have found themselves asking. It's been overwhelming, Renee Feldpausch, an ICU charge nurse at Trinity Rock Island with nearly 30 years of experience, said about halfway through a recent 12-hour-plus shift. I am very tired, physically and mentally. The drain is awful. I have nurses who are very distraught. It's the mental exhaustion that has been a majority of our staff's distress. As a charge nurse, Feldpausch Davenport, 53, manages the day-to-day operations of the unit during her shift at the Unity Point Health Hospital. All admissions, discharges, placements go through her, and she supervises the staff. In addition, she takes a patient or two herself because she thinks it's important for managers to have hands-on experience. While previously that patient might have been someone coming out of heart surgery, these days it's more typically a COVID-19 patient. And she has 3. Best practices in ICU call for 2 patients per nurse, with the exception of a limited number of patients who are 1-to-1 based on certain equipment they have in use. Since the pandemic began in March, Trinity has enlarged its intensive care unit from 20 beds to 42 in 3 different units. An additional 8 beds are available if needed. On Wednesday, the ICU nurses were caring for 24 patients, 21 with COVID-19. Of those, 9 were on ventilators. In mid-afternoon, one of them coded, meaning the patient either stopped breathing or their pulse stopped, sending out a message over the unit floors for all hands on deck. This was something we weren't prepared for, Feldpausch said, in the pandemic. It surprised all of us, really. And she and others watched and read reports about outbreaks in February and on the East and West Coasts. No one knew what we would see, she said. One of the most difficult aspects of a nurse's job during this time, and the primary cause of mental exhaustion, is having to tell families that they can't see their loved ones. This includes people who have been married 60 or 70 years. They're elderly, old, and apart, and they've never been apart before, Feldpausch said. And day after day, nurses have to explain over the phone to family members who can't see their loved one just how sick their loved one is. If the family member could see their loved one, they would get a better idea, but nurses have to try and put it into words, over and over, again and again, and yes, they are doing everything they can. We have strong staff, but this has been emotionally challenging for them. Having to be that surrogate family member, Orton said, as a charge nurse, Feldpausch routinely stays over to make sure charting is finished or to perhaps help with recently admitted patients who needs to get stabilized, rather than drop off that responsibility on someone just coming on the shift. It depends on the patients. It depends on the day. Patients don't come in on a schedule. Sometimes she'll stay over to fill a 4-hour gap, rather than have another nurse assigned 4 patients. You don't want to leave a nurse with 4 patients, she said. Does she go home and crash, sleeping until the next shift? No, you don't want to waste that day off, she said. She tries to get outdoors as well as cross off jobs that need to be done around her house. It's like any job where you juggle. Help from other departments, the public. The extra load with COVID-19 patients has been lightened somewhat by nurses from other departments helping in ICU, Feldbausch said. We've tried to look at areas where we could maximize staff for the largest number of patients. As for help for the exhausted nurses themselves, Feldbausch said, the try to support each other. Our chaplains come down and do daily prayers. You can have faith and not be religious, and we're grateful and so blessed with our patients sending us letters. And schools send us cards. They're so kind, and some just make you laugh. Feldpausch quit watching the news some time ago because it was all bad. She stumped by some of the public's reaction towards the virus. Some people still don't believe it, she said. I don't know what they think we're doing here. Orton feels similarly. That is a frustration with the people who are working with COVID. These people are so sick and the nurses are physically tired, emotionally tired, and it just impacts the community in such a big way. It's about so much more than COVID, too. It's about the staff resources, she said. To feel like the community thinks that this is just the flu, it really impacts everyone in the community. How her life has changed. Her hopes. Because her 2 children are adults, living on their own, Feldpausch has never had to worry about concentrating the virus and unwittingly bringing it home before she knew she had it, and she never has contracted it. When the weather was still nice, and she and co-workers would meet outside, maybe in someone's backyard, to share food and drinks from a safe distance apart. Our work family is a huge part of who and what we are. Like everyone, Feldpausch misses close contact with family and friends. She has a great niece who was born last December that she hasn't gotten to know. You can Zoom, but it's not the same. She has a group of high school friends who typically go on a trip together every year, and we didn't go last year. When the pandemic is over, she hopes that one positive twist is that we get more nurses out of this. We are having difficulty getting people into nursing as it was. I'm fearful of this, but it's such an amazing profession. And with a license, you can do so many different things. Orton just wants to get back to that work and life balance. She wants to get back to the more of balance between the personal and the professional. Until that time comes, Orton is doing her best to cling to the bonds that she does have at work with her fellow nurses and at home with her family, both of which have strengthened during the pandemic. Those will get her through until shopping can resume. Now on to some more local stories, starting with turning barn into art gallery. Farmer's Barn Passion transformed into new offerings at Cupola Inn. Dale Mills has always had a passion for old barns. Round ones are by far his favorite, but he has an appreciation for the craftsmanship of polygonal and stone ones, too. They are just so cool, he said, with childlike excitement. His passion for playing and working in them, and over the years, it's grown into a hobby of thousands of photographs, barn books, and a collection of barn calendars, and a variety of functional and decorative barn items on the property of he and his wife Judy own just outside Mason City in rural Nora Springs. The couple opened Cupola Inn Bed and Breakfast, a 4-bedroom, barn-themed destination in 1996. Within the past year, Dale's interest in barns and ability to sit down in his 40-year-old collection, what their adult children lovingly call farm junk, have combined into 2 new offerings for the bed and breakfast. Welcome to my barn passion, Dale said, directing his arms toward farm equipment repurposed into art outside his old cattle shed. Monday morning, my barn passion that got totally out of control, completely out of control. The area, which is marked by dozens of feet of artificial green grass carpet, is called the Barnyard Art Gallery. It features items like a horse, spider, owls, and flowers welded together using old farm equipment like horseshoes, saw blades, shovels, rotary hoe wheels, hay forks, tractor seats, wrenches, and chains, and purchased over the years at farm sales and auctions. Dale, who was a livestock farmer up until a few years ago, said he taught himself how to weld a year or two ago by watching YouTube videos. He operated a 500-head hog operation on 5 lots up until the B&B opened, and he had a small beef cattle operation up until a few years ago. "I can't really call myself an artist, but when you get an idea, you go with it," Dale said. One of his favorite ideas in the gallery is the family tree that he welded together using old farm equipment. He uses wrenches to denotate their children, Emily, Aaron, Eli, and Ava, and welded them together with other wrenches if they were married and if they had children. "That was a fun one, just to use up a bunch of old wrenches and stuff," Dale said. But his biggest project, Judy said, is inside the former hog building and the old cattle shed. "This is my salute to Barnes," Dale said, opening the door to reveal a barn-turned-gallery featuring dozens, if not hundreds, of neatly placed images of barns with carpet, an air hockey table, and a replica of the oldest barn in Cerro Gordo County. He calls it his Barn IMAX exhibit. The images are from barn calendars Dale has received from his wife and children each Christmas since at least 1995 that he never had the heart to throw away. "There are too many good pictures in there," he said. One day earlier this fall, Dale said he was in the barn and got the idea to turn the walls into a display. So, display they did. In about 5 days, Dale and Judy sorted through and organized years' worth of barn calendars into styles, seasons, and other categories, taking advantage of the 40-degree weather that followed Thanksgiving. What I like most about this is when you put up pictures around the beams and the nailers here and leave the space. It looked like they're framed," he said. "And if something happens to one of the pictures," Judy said, "he's got plenty extra." The space, Judy said, will be an expansion of the B&B and something else for the guests and their family to enjoy. Kupala Inn Bed and Breakfast attracts visitors from across the state, country, and world, and it provides an opportunity to educate them about barns and farming. "It helps raise awareness, I think," Dale said. "Barns today are obsolete unless they're converted into machine sheds or used for another purpose." And now, let's read Film Made Locally, set for release Tuesday. Two Ways Home features Mason City native Frederick. A movie filmed and produced in North Iowa will soon be available to a broader audience. Two Ways Home, starring Mason City native Tana Frederick, will be released video on demand by Gravitas Ventures on Tuesday. "I really want people to leave this movie feeling like if they had dealt with any sort of mental health issue, whether it's post-traumatic stress disorder from war or postpartum after giving birth or mild anxiety or whatever it is, it's okay to talk about it," Frederick said in an interview earlier this year. "You are a hero if you talk about it, and you're a hero helping others cope with it." That may sound lofty, but I think that there can't be enough movies that give the message out there in society right now. The movie, which has been endorsed by National Alliance on Mental Illness, was slated to premiere at the North Iowa Behavioral Healthcare Summit in April in North Iowa Area Community College, but due to COVID-19 pandemic, it was postponed. Two Ways Home follows Kathy, a woman newly diagnosed with bipolar disorder, who was released from prison on good behavior and returns to rural Iowa to reconnect with her estranged 12-year-old daughter and her cankerous elderly grandfather, who has PTSD from his wartime service. Her return home is turbulent and rough, unwelcome transition in which she must come to terms with her diagnosis and its implications on her identity, while also realizing that her family was happier while she was gone. As Kathy struggles to maintain balance with her condition, complications with her daughter's well-being and her grandfather's health put her self-worth to the ultimate test. My character is a very tough woman who has been faced adversity having been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, but her true grit comes from being Iowan and her ability to be herself, which I think demonstrates what I've seen in the woman that I've grown up with, Frederick said of her character, Kathy. Two Ways Home, directed by Ron Vigone, showcases small town beauty and highlights the importance of mental wellness and self-discovery. The 90-minute movie, based on an original screenplay by Richard Chenow, a family friend of Frederick, was filmed and produced entirely in Iowa. Frederick said footage for the movie, which she also produced, was shot at her grandparents' farm as well as familiar North Iowa locations like Pilot Knob State Park, Garner Aquatic Center, Matt's Place, Goldie's, and Clear Lake 4th of July celebration. We had a whole community help us out, she said. It was absolutely amazing, and the film turned out really, really wonderfully, and is winning a lot of awards at festivals. Frederick, who has been working on the movie since 2014, said she was a real stickler about portraying mental health in Two Ways Home accurately and compassionately because of her parents' involvement with organizations that helped people with mental health issues during her childhood. Her mother was a nursing professor who taught psychology and pediatrics in North Iowa, while her father worked in pharmacies and created a med set for the mentally ill so they could be on track with their medications and provide a support system. Frederick said she called her parents frequently to discuss aspects of the movie and referred to them as her field study guides. I want to be very real and honest, she said. If I want people to go along with the journey, I want it to be very personal. Since completing the post-production of the independent film, it's won numerous awards for its content and talent, including Best Picture at the Fort Myers Beach International Film Festival, Best Actress Feature Film at the Mariana Del Rey Film Festival, and the Woman Empowerment Award at Women Texas Film Festival. In addition to garnering attention and recognition at film festivals across the U.S., Frederick said Two Ways Home has more importantly created awareness about life and mental health. To me, that's the best feeling that comes from being an artist, is creating social change, she said. We didn't set out to do that, we just set out to create a good movie, but like I said, we're so lucky to have such an amazing team on this film that they made this into something that can be creating change. For more information and updates about Two Ways Home or to pre-order it, visit www.twowayshomemovie.com or follow its Facebook page. Now on to the article, Retailers Brace for Flood of Returns from Online Shopping. A huge surge in online shopping during the pandemic has been a savior for retailers, but it comes at a price. Shoppers are expected to return twice as many items as they did during last year's holiday period, costing companies roughly $1.1 billion, according to Navar Inc., a software and technology company that manages online returns for hundreds of brands. Retailers don't want the returns, but they do want shoppers who may not feel safe going to stores and being comfortable buying things that they haven't seen or tried in person. People have been doing so much about online buying since March that carriers like UPS and FedEx were already full capacity before the holiday shopping season, and online sales just kept soaring. From November 1st through Tuesday, they spiked 32% to $171.6 billion compared with the year-ago period. According to Adobe Analytics, the massive challenges of shipping COVID-19 vaccines in weeks and months ahead could put further pressure on the system. That means shoppers get refunds until 2 weeks after they've sent it back to the store, said Sarah Skirball, shopping expert at deals site RetailMeNot. Many companies are offering more locations where customers can drop off returns, which cut down shipping costs and get refunds to shoppers more quickly. Last year, Kohl's began allowing Amazon returns at all of its 1,000 stores. Customers drop off items for free, with no box or label needed. This year, Amazon customers can also return items at 500 Whole Foods Market stores. That's in addition to Amazon's deal with UPS to allow similar drop-offs at UPS stores. Happy Returns, a Santa Monica, California-based startup that works with about 150 online retailers like Rothy's and Revolve, has increased its number of drop-off locations to 2,600 from more than 700 last year. That includes 2,000 FedEx locations. It's been a great time to be in the returns business. Every day there's a record, said David Sobey, CEO and co-founder of Happy Returns, noting he's processed 50% more returns in December than November. Walmart, the nation's largest retailer, announced earlier this week that it will pick up items shipped and sold by Walmart.com from customers' homes for free through a new partnership with FedEx. The service will continue beyond the holiday shopping season. A growing number of retailers are asking shoppers to not even bother sending back certain rejected items. When Dick Perozio wanted to return a too small jersey he bought for $40 on a website called Online Cycling Gear, he was pleasantly surprised with the response. The site told him to keep it, disregard it, or give it to a friend or charity, and will send him the right size and an extra $10. I was fine with that, said the 77-year-old cycling enthusiast from Wesley, Massachusetts. I did a good thing for a friend and I got a new shirt. The experience, he says, has given him confidence to buy more online this holiday season. David Basuk, global co-leader for Alix Partners retail practice, says stores are increasingly making it easier for shoppers to feel less guilty about returning items. If they're not sure about their size, and they order both sizes, he says. If they're not sure about which color, they order both colors. And if they're not sure about which item, they order all of them. But it's costly to retailers, and the retailers are not well positioned to handle all of the cost. On average, people return 25% of items they buy online, compared to the only 8% of what they buy in stores. According to Forrester, Research's online analyst, Sucharita Mulapru, for clothing, it's even higher, about 30%, but it's not all rejected items are the same and have varying levels of depreciation, experts say. After an item is sent back to the retailer, the company must assess its condition and decide whether to resell it, send it to a liquidator, or the landfill. Operato, a return logistics company, estimates the value of fashion apparel depreciates by 20% to 50% over an 8 to 16 week period. That's why it's so critical to get rejected items back and on sale quickly. Returns are also complicated this year because retailers push people to buy holiday gifts early to avoid shipping delays and crowded stores, meaning the return window may be closed by the time Christmas rolls around. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for December the 26th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Looks like there's actually only one obituary today. It's Jake G. Winter. Jake G. Winter, 94, of Buffalo Center, died Monday, December 21st, 2020, at the Timely Mission Nursing Home in Buffalo Center. A private family funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, December 28, 2020, at Bethlehem Lutheran Church, Buffalo Center. Burial will be held in Graceland Cemetery. The funeral service and graveside service will be live-streamed on Oak Crest Funeral Services Facebook page, www.oakcrestfuneralservices.com. Now let's read a few national articles before we read the sports. Let's start with warning blared before blast. Three injured, human remains found, outages were widespread. a recreational vehicle parked in front of the deserted streets of downtown Nashville exploded early Christmas morning, causing widespread communication outages that took down police emergency systems and grounded holiday travel at the city's airport. Authorities said that they believed the blast was intentional. Police were responding to reports of shots fired Friday when they encountered the RV blaring a recorded warning that a bomb would detonate in 15 minutes. Metro Nashville Police Chief John Drake said, "Police evacuated nearby buildings and called in bomb squad. The RV exploded shortly afterward," Drake said at a midday news conference. Police did not immediately indicate a possible motive or the target. "It looks like the bomb went off on Second Avenue," Nashville Mayor John Cooper said after touring the site. Cooper issued a state of emergency and a curfew for the area. Police did not immediately indicate a possible motive or the target. Three people were taken to area hospitals for treatment after the blast, although none were in critical condition, Aaron said. Cooper said the city was lucky that the number of injuries was limited. Authorities don't know whether anyone in the vehicle when it exploded. Human remains were found in the vicinity, two law enforcement officials told the Associated Press. It was unclear how the remains were related to the explosion or whether they might belong to the person believed to be responsible or a victim. The officials could not discuss on any ongoing investigation publicly and spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity. The blast sent smoke and flames billowing from the heart of downtown Nashville's tourist scene, an area packed with honky-tonks, restaurants, and shops. Buildings shook and windows shattered streets away from the explosion near a building owned by the AT&T that lies one block from the company's office tower, a landmark in downtown. "We do not know if this was a coincidence or if it was intention," police spokesman Don Aaron said. AT&T said the affected building is the central office of a telephone exchange, with network equipment in it. The blast interrupted service, but the company declined to say how widespread outages were. The Federal Aviation Administration temporarily halted flights out of Nashville International Airport because of telecommunicational issues associated with the explosion. Now on to Biden climate team faces even warmer planet. The effects of climate change were already apparent in 2016 when Donald Trump, then president-elect, introduced his team of nominees to lead energy and environmental policies and help unleash American fossil energy industries. Now, 4 years and more than 100 rollbacks of energy, transportation, and environmental rules later, an even warmer planet spawning even more devastating hurricanes and a record-setting wildfires awaits President-elect Joe Biden's team. Biden finalized what he called his climate team last week. Republican Deb Haaland, for the Interior Secretary, former of Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, for Energy Secretary, North Carolina Environmental Regulatory Michael Regan for EPA Administrator, and Brenda Mallory to chair the Council on Environmental Quality, a White House agency. The group, joined by International Climate Advisor John Kerry and domestic aides Gina McCarthy and Ali Zaldi, my apologies for mispronunciation there, who both worked in the Obama administration facing the daunting task of reining in heat-trapping greenhouse gas emissions, re-engaging foreign leaders on environmental issues, restoring and revitalizing climate-related relations eliminated or weakened by the Trump administration, nudging along climate legislation in Congress, and doing it all in the midst of an economic crisis triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic. It showed its high priority for the administration to engage around the different corners of the climate, whether it's at the interior or inside the White House or in the cabinet, Heather Reams, Executive Director of Citizens for Responsible Energy Solutions, a right-leaning clean energy group, said the rollout. This is clustered together in a way to tell a story. The incoming administration's objectives will surely be harder if Republicans maintain their Senate majority, a fate that hangs in the balance until runoff elections in Georgia early next month. Even if Democrats take control of the Senate, the chamber's rules and regional differences within the party have proved obstacles to high-impact climate legislation. In 2010, while Democrats controlled the White House and both congressional chambers, they could not get a carbon tax into law. Senate control would allow Democrats to set up an agenda and use procedural maneuvers to press through their causes. The big legislation would likely require overcoming the filibuster, Reams said, making centrist Senator Joe Manchin III a power broker to the irrigation of progressive Democrats. Now let's move on to some sports articles, starting with Iowa's Helfen right at home. Transfer from NIU anchors Hawkeyes' defensive line. Iowa defensive tackle Jack Helfen is right where he always wanted to be. The Prophetstown, Illinois native has turned his childhood aspirations into reality, suiting up this season for number 17 Hawkeyes after 4 years in Northern Illinois. "It's lived up to all the hype in my head and that I had been growing up as a kid," the 22-year-old Helfen said as Hawkeyes prepared a season-ending showdown with Missouri in the Music City Bowl next Wednesday. Growing up an Iowa fan, Helfen didn't receive much attention from the Hawkeyes or any Power 5 program. He attended a number of recruiting camps around the Midwest, including a few in Iowa City, but flew under the radar. He would go up against guys that were top recruits in one-on-ones, and he would do really well, Helfen's mother, Judy Breitbach, said. A lot of times, he would hold his own or beat him. The coaches would coach up the other kid on how he could have done better to beat Jack. He was always such a small school and always had a chip on his shoulder. Northern Illinois was the only school to show palpable interest in Helfen, and he opted to walk on as a freshman in 2016. Just days before his first game, Helfen injured his shoulder and underwent surgery for a torn labrum, ending his first season of college football. "He was actually taken off by the roster at Northern Illinois," Breitbach said. "It was a pretty dark time for him." Helfen redshirted that season and eventually made his way back to the Northern Illinois defensive line mix. He earned a scholarship at the end of fall camp, heading into his second season. From there, he never looked back. Helfen racked up to 72 tackles, 9 sacks, and 3 forced fumbles over the next 3 seasons, and a senior in 2019 earned All-America honors from Pro Football Focus. Helfen wanted to use his final season of eligibility to boost his stock in the NFL draft, so he entered the transfer portal after graduating. He immediately began fielding interest from a number of schools, including Iowa. The Hawkeyes reached out early. Iowa defensive line coach Kelvin Bell messaged Helfen, and from there a connection grew. "I was really excited when Iowa started pursuing me," Helfen said. "That's where my interest was leaning towards the whole time in the portal." The Hawkeyes were front runners, but the Helfen wanted to take his time. So the lineman, his girlfriend, and golden retriever traveled to Colorado Springs, out of phone range, to contemplate his options. Helfen returned from Colorado with a decision. "It was pretty clear to him," his mother said. Iowa was where he got the chills when he thought about playing there, where he got butterflies in his stomach. Helfen announced his decision to transfer to Iowa in May, and he turned heads from the start. "He's like a 45-year-old guy that lives next to you, the kind of neighbor you want to visit with," Iowa football head coach Kirk Fertness said. "He's awesome. He's brought good life to our team, and he's pretty tough, hard-minded guy." Helfen's mother said the neighborhood comparison fit her son perfectly. "Jack doesn't know a stranger," Breitbach said. He can talk to anybody. He just has that personality. I thought it was well said by Kirk, because I can relate to that quite a bit. He's always been able to talk to just about everybody. He truly cares about people. Though, through 8 games this season, Helfand has 21 tackles, a sack, and playing a key role in anchoring one of the nation's top defenses. Statistics aside, Helfand's achieved a dream he chased since childhood. I don't think I could have written a script that had been any better for him, his mother said. Now on to Iowa State players' Coach Win Top Awards. Cyclones Hall Rose win offensive and defensive honors. Iowa State running back Breece Hall and linebacker Mike Rose are the Associated Press Big 12 Offensive and Defensive Players of the Year after the Cyclones' best conference season ever also earned Matt Campbell Coach of the Year honors. The Big 12 runner-up Cyclones will play in the New Year's Six Bowl for the first time, facing Oregon in the Fiesta Bowl. They were a league-best 8-1 in the Big 12 during the regular season before a 27-21 loss to Oklahoma in the championship game. The 8 conference wins were a school record. Hall is the Big 12 leader with 130.5 yards rushing per game and 19 touchdowns, and has a TD in every game this season. The sophomore was the unanimous pick as the top offensive player when the AP All Big 12 Team Individual Awards were revealed Thursday, as determined by the vote of a panel of 20 sports writers and sportscasters who regularly cover the league. Rose got 11 of the 20 votes as the top defender. The junior tied for the Big 12 lead with 90 total tackles and 4 interceptions, along with 10 tackles for a loss. Oklahoma redshirt freshman quarterback Spencer Rattler was a first-ream pick and shared new Corner of the Year honors with West Virginia senior linebacker Tony Fields II, a transfer from Arizona. Each received 7 votes, and Fields also got 4 votes for Defensive Player of the Year. Texas junior Joseph Osall, who plays a hybrid position for the Longhorns, got 3 votes for Top Defensive Player. He got votes for defensive end and linebacker on the All-Big 12 team, enough to be selected second team at both positions. Campbell, in his 5th season at Iowa State, got all 20 votes as Coach of the Year. Iowa State had 4 first-team selections for the AP All Big 12 team, matching Oklahoma and Texas Tech from the most in the league. Now let's read some more local sports articles. Return to podium, a goal for Peterson. With knee healed, West Fork sophomore ranked number 1 in the state. Growing up, wrestling was Cale Peterson's favorite sport, and he was good at it. It was the summer of 2019, and Peterson was excited to get his freshman wrestling season at West Fork underway. But during his training for the upcoming season, Peterson kept feeling pain in his knee. At first, he ignored it. Then, he took a break to let it heal. But the moment he came back, the pain was still there, so his parents took him to a doctor in Mason City. They looked it over and said that a piece of my bone inside of my knee had stopped growing and had died, Peterson said. I would have to get that taken out or it could put holes and get the blood flowing back through it so it could hopefully come back and regrow. Peterson went with the latter. He had surgery done in August of 2019. There were many things that could have gone wrong, including a 30% chance that the bone didn't heal the way it was supposed to. He could have missed his entire freshman season. It was hard on me. I was scared, Peterson said. I kept praying that I would be able to wrestle and hopefully make it to the state tournament. However, he managed to make it back just in time for the postseason wrestling tournaments. He advanced through the sectionals, and then through districts. He ended his season on the podium at the state tournament at the Wells Fargo Arena, placing 6th in the 106-pound weight class. Pretty impressive for an underclassman who didn't hit the mat for a majority of the season. It's exciting that I placed, but at the same time, if I wouldn't have had the surgery, I would have placed way higher than what I did, Peterson said. Fast forward to today, where Peterson sits at the Class 1A number one ranked wrestler in the latest predicament rankings in his sophomore season. He says his knee feels great and he's excited to get a full season under his belt. Although Peterson is ranked at the top, his head coach Jared Arbogast doesn't love the idea of rankings. I don't know what it means to Kale, but we both know that it doesn't mean anything if we don't go out and put in some hard work, Arbogast said. Keep getting better every day because there's always somebody out there who's going to try and outcompete you if you don't. For Peterson, the goals are set at a lofty standard. Win the state tournament and stand on the top of the podium. But he has a lot of work to do before that can happen. Peterson's strength, according to both him and his head coach, is his ability to move on his feet out of the neutral position. He's strong, aggressive, and quick. But the quickest way to achieve goals is to figure out things you might not be as strong on and improve at them. We need to work on the bottom, and that's a concern of mine with him, Arbogast said. For the one thing his coach wants him to work on, he prefaced it by rattling off a long list of things Peterson does really well. West Fork has wrestlers outside of Peterson that are also looking to make it to the state tournament. Arbogast has high hopes for senior heavyweight Levy Jansen. I'd like to see Levy make it to the state tournament, Arbogast said. He's put a lot of work in, and he's always had one of the toughest heavyweight brackets around. Arbogast said Jansen does everything the right way and is a solid leader for the program, a role that he hopes Peterson can grow into as time moves on. He's learning how to be a good teammate and to be a leader by just going out and doing his thing, Arbogast said. I think that's my goal for Kale, is to basically grow into that role. Peterson, Jansen, and the West Fork wrestling team will compete at 6 p.m. on January 7th at North Butler. Spots, a bright spot for Mohawks. Young Mason City girls team has plenty of optimism. In Mason City, the future is bright. Sure, the Mohawks girls basketball team has an 0-8 record, but if you look beyond its standings, it's easy to find reasons for optimism. In their final two games before winter break, the Mohawks put up a fight against a pair of ranked teams as they fell to Class 5A No. 7 Cedar Falls 71-69 and lost to Class 4A No. 7 Waverly Shellrock 49-45 in a game the Mohawks began in a 12-0 hole. While an 8-0 record has been a new experience for head coach Kurt Collison, who led the team to the state semifinals just 2 years ago, he sees plenty of reasons for the team to be excited, thanks to its freshman-led offensive attack. This season, three of the team's five starters are freshmen. The Mohawks are led on offense by freshman Reggie Spots, who has a team high 144 points this year and is tied for 8th in the state with 23 three-pointers. Spots has been a bright spot for the Mohawks, who lost 7 seniors to graduation. She understands the game well, Collison said. She is competitive and works really hard at it. She has a great attitude. She is always ready to play and is a great teammate too. For a freshman, she really communicates well and her teammates love her. It's a credit to her how she has come in and handled that. Before the season, Collison named Spots as a player that Mohawks fans will have a lot of fun watching over the next 4 years. On Tuesday night, against Waverly Shellrock, Spots put up 16 points on 6 of 13 shooting with 4 three-pointers. For her, the opportunity to come in and play a major role her freshman year has been a blast. I knew I was going to have to step up and be one of the leaders on the team, Spots said. I knew I was ready for it. I was working hard all summer, and all my coaches and peers got me ready for this and pushed me hard. Obviously, the season has not had the result the team was hoping for early on, but with the brutal schedule that they have played so far, their struggles weren't necessarily a surprise. Aside from the 7 departed seniors, the team has been decimated on the injury front. Tegan Barkema has missed the whole season after sustaining an injury during volleyball season, and senior Emma Hollander missed a chunk of time as well due to illness. But that has left room for players like Spots and fellow freshmen Grace Birding and Kesley McDonough to step forward into starting roles. After a bumpy first couple of weeks, the young lineup seems to be settling in. I think we knew that there was going to be a lot of challenges, and we had a tough schedule to start with, Callison said. We're at the point where they aren't freshmen anymore, and with our youth and inexperience, there are no excuses anymore. We've had enough time to work together and create our own team. In addition to Spots, Birding has contributed team-high 13 steals on the year and 33 rebounds, with McDonough has 29 rebounds and 8 assists. As far as veteran leadership, the Mohawks have relied on junior Jada Williams to set the tone. She is really positive and sticks up for her teammates, Spots said. She has some really good words to say before and after the games. As the team's most experienced starting player, Williams has stepped into a vocal leadership role, something that she never had to do in the past with a program that was full of upperclassmen. After the two most recent Mohawk games, Williams is eager to get the season started again after winter break. Williams put up a triple-double in Mason City's game last Friday against Ames, the first triple-double that Callison could remember in his 14 years leading the program. The very next day, Williams had a double-double against Cedar Falls. I'm very excited, especially right now, Williams said. We're doing pretty good. We've learned a lot, and we have been pretty close with a lot of teams. You can tell that their confidence is growing, and after this break, I think we should start winning games. The atmosphere of the team going into winter break is upbeat and excited, but Callison said that he is making sure that they are careful in that regard. While it might be easy to brush off the losses and attribute them to youth, the team needs to make sure that it isn't sacrificing the present in favor of the future. The future matters, of course. For the seniors on the roster, this season is the most important one. It's kind of a trade-off there, Callison said. You want to stay positive, but you also want kids to understand that we're not just playing for the future, we're playing for now. The potential that we have to get a lot better by the end of the season and make a great tournament run are still no question in my mind. Mason City will return to action January 5th at Marshalltown. Let's finish up today with Packers LaFleur ready to match up with former boss Vrabel. All the concern about how well Green Bay Packers coach Matt LaFleur would work with veteran quarterback Aaron Rodgers have disappeared near the end of their second season together. LaFleur, who came to Green Bay after one unremarkable season as the Tennessee Titans offensive coordinator, has teamed with Rodgers to make Green Bay one of the NFL's most dynamic offenses. The 41-year-old LaFleur has emerged as one of the league's bright young coaches as he prepares to face his former boss Sunday night when the NFC North champions Packers host the Titans in a matchup between two of the NFL's highest-scoring teams. Mike Vrabel has the Titans 10-0 on the verge of a second straight playoff berth. LaFleur owns a 26-6 record at Green Bay and is one of only 6 coaches in the NFL history to win at least 24 of their first 30 games. He's come a long way since that 2018 season at Tennessee, where the Titans ranked 25th in yards per game and 27th in points per game, while going 9-7 and failing to reach the playoffs. Yet LaFleur says he's learned plenty from that year working with Vrabel, who held everyone accountable, from his coaches to every player on the roster. He was really direct in his communication, laid out expectations, LaFleur said. They were crystal clear for everybody. You knew where you stood, and you knew what your responsibilities were and what the expectations were. I thought he did an outstanding job with that. It's something I've tried to carry over as well. Green Bay's offense had one of its few hiccups last week, as the Packers scored touchdowns on their first three drives but gained only 49 yards after halftime in a 24-16 victory over the Carolina Panthers. That victory gives the Packers plenty of incentive as LaFleur gets ready to match up against Vrabel, who has noticed how well his former offensive coordinator has fared in Green Bay. Sunday's game will mark the first time the third-year Titans coach has matched wits with the head coach who has once worked on his staff. I think Matt's got confidence to him and that what he believes in, Vrabel said. I think he's a hard worker. I think he's got a toughness to him, having been in a lot of different places, worked his way up. Not afraid to move his family for another opportunity and then turn that opportunity into something else. Those are all really strong qualities. I do think he's learned from the people he's been around, and he's been around a lot of great coaches. LaFleur looked forward to showing Vrabel how much he's grown over the last couple of seasons. I really enjoyed my time in Tennessee, like I said, learning a lot, LaFleur said. Now I hope we come up with a good game plan and play our best football and go beat their butt. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for December the 26th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.